Welcome to the Euro Hockey Institute podcast, in conversation with the biggest names in sport, generating insight and engagement around coaching, officiating, and playing hockey. Presented by Jack Rolfe.
Helen, Rich and Walsh, welcome to the European Hockey podcast. As we were saying before, this is now the full house because we've had Kate, Rich and Walsh on the podcast in series one. So in series four, we are now in a full house and got yourself on. So really grateful for your time and your energy that you're going to bring in some topics that we're going to discuss. I wrote down three key words: transition, people and winning. There's some topic areas and kind of preempting where the conversation is going to go today. But maybe for some of the listeners, start with where you are now and what that journey's looked like and maybe why we invited you onto the podcast.
Wow. Okay. So yeah, where am I now? Well, I'm living in North London, which is a really nice part of the world to live in. Having retired from international hockey in 2016, after the Rio Olympic Games, that was the last time I picked up an international stick. I played for England and Great Britain for nearly 18 years. So I made my debut in 1999, which just seems like such a long time ago now. And yeah, I think, you know, my career had many, many ups and downs, probably mainly downs, if I'm honest, in terms of results. And also I had a couple of really bad injuries. But, you know, really grateful that kind of as a governing body or as a team, certainly we managed to sort stuff out to the kind of back end of my career and managed to have a few really good results. Actually really started to compete for world medals for, you know, the last kind of 6-7 years of my career. So that was, you know, nice to have at the end. And now, you know, having stopped playing hockey, kind of having to think about something else to do. And to be honest, I've done various bits and pieces. The Olympic gold medal opened up a huge amount of doors that wouldn't have been there if that hadn't happened, which, you know, very lucky to have had. And I guess the main thing that I'm focusing on now is kind of psychology. I got a master's in organizational psychology and I'm on the way to working through the next steps of my qualification to become, you know, a kind of fully fledged psychologist. And I'm doing various roles with that and working with Spurs women as their kind of high performance coach and culture coach. And, you know, working with various corporates as well, companies, and yeah, doing a few keynotes and still doing a little bit of hockey coaching as well. So yeah, lots of different stuff going on at the moment.
And hockey players are very traditional in terms of being incredibly humble. So I've got down here 4 times Olympian, 2-time Olympic medalist, European champion, Commonwealth champion, countless champions trophies within that as well. And maybe something more recently of writing a book, which not many people, or a lot of people may talk about, but maybe not a lot of people actually go and do. So just share a little bit about that and give it a big plug straight off.
Yeah, thanks, Jack. Yeah, you're right. I think a lot of people do say, oh, I really want to write a book. And I was one of those people back in 2014 when I was going through my back injury. And I was like, oh, I really want to write a book about this because there's so much I feel like people can learn from it. And actually, when Kate and I sat down to do it, it was very, very hard. I think there was probably pros and cons to us doing it together. I think we kind of, you know, forced each other at various points to sit down and get writing. And actually, I have to say, COVID helped with that, kind of gave us a bit more time than perhaps we would have done. But yeah, we both played in the team since 99, and we, the amount of stuff we learn about people, about teams, about ourselves, and how you get the best out of, I think probably how you get the best out of yourself first and foremost, but then how you work together as a team. And this, you know, the stuff that we did on developing our culture and creating an environment where everybody had value, you know, whether you were the captain and the most experienced player in the team, or whether you were the newest, youngest member, you had value in that group. And when when people feel like they have value and they have something to contribute, then you're always going to get way more out of them. And so, yeah, we wanted to kind of share the things that we'd learned. There's some quite kind of personal learnings in there as well about our own leadership styles, and how we were led, and then how we kind of developed as individuals, but also as a team working towards, you know, the London Olympics in particular. That was where the massive change kind of took place. And then obviously going on to Rio as well.
Which I'm sure we'll discuss shortly. But I started the podcast with three words, which are transition, people, and winning. When I say those words, what comes to mind straight away?
Well, I think winning was, I think, quite a significant word for me personally. I grew up the youngest of four. I've got three older brothers, and it was always a really competitive environment growing up. We always, you know, playing two on two, whatever sport it was. And for me, it was always about winning. I have to say, you know, I just loved it. I love winning. And I think actually the thing that springs to mind when I hear that word is how, in particular, the last 18 months towards Rio Olympics, we literally learned how to win. You know, we kind of had conversations around our vision and our values and the behaviors we wanted to exhibit as a team. And one of our values was we are winners, because if we're honest, I think at that time we perhaps didn't quite, like, you know, it was there or thereabouts, but it wasn't consistent, and it wasn't throughout the whole squad. We didn't quite have that winning mentality that we needed to have in order to win an Olympic gold medal. And that had to change. And so we needed to really start talking about winning. We needed to celebrate winning as a squad, however uncomfortable that made individuals feel, because, you know, when you're on the losing team and you've got people celebrating in your face, that's really uncomfortable. But what that does is that creates that environment where you want to be on the winning team, because you know, not to rub it in someone's face, but to, you know, because you're kind of trying to make people want to be winners. And so there's the mindset piece, but there's also the stuff around the you know, the kind of processes that you go through towards critical moments within a game, you know, when you score or when you concede, what happens to you when you're, you know, the last few minutes of the game and you're a goal up or you're a goal down or you're drawing, and, you know, what's the collective mindset, you know, is everybody on the same page first and foremost, and then it's about, you know, finding a way to win. And actually that became a bit of a mantra for us at the Rio Olympics. It was find a way to win. However we do it, we find a way to win. And so that's probably the one that sticks out the most for me from those three words.
Mm. And if we did talk about winning, there's the flip side of not winning. And 12 years prior to Rio 2016 and Beijing in 2004, GB women come ninth place. And just take us inside that journey of your second Olympics. You made your debut in 2000 when you was 18 and, you know, fresh out of school and probably loving everything. And then going to your second Olympics, having a bit more awareness of what it's like in a village in that multi-sport environment. What was that like?
Yeah, so I have to say, actually going into Sydney, yeah, you're right. I was very young and I was very naive about what kind of world hockey was about. And I genuinely thought we could go there and win it. And so when we didn't, we ended up finishing 8th out of 10. And when we didn't, I was a bit kind of disillusioned. I was like, okay, this is not how it's supposed to go. And it really made me question what I was doing and what we were doing as a squad. And then going into Beijing, you know, we actually ended up finishing 6th out of 12 in Beijing. And we kind of came away from that tournament, you know, with, and probably came away from that tournament with similar feelings to other tournaments where you kind of think, oh, we were so close. Oh, we just got that goal. That hadn't hit the post and it had gone in. And, you know, kind of those types of conversations that are happening. But in reality, we're miles off. You know, that is the difference between winning and losing, those fine margins. And so many people, you know, say about oh, we were so close, if that, and it's like, yeah, but that is the difference. And that was the stuff that we needed to sort out. And so I think, you know, going into Beijing, I probably was a bit more, I certainly didn't have the same naivety as I did for the Sydney Olympics. I was more realistic with our chances, but I still believed that we could win. I always believed we could win, always. But, you know, one of the things that stands out from the Beijing Olympics was the fact that we went into that tournament not all on the same page. We didn't have the same vision as a squad. So, you know, I remember a meeting that we had, you know, kind of what would it have been about 6 months prior to the Olympics, about what we wanted to achieve in Beijing and kind of, you know, what are our expectations. And we left that room, that meeting. Some people wanted to try and win it, and other people were happy finishing sixth. And funnily enough, we finished sixth. So that was my massive lesson from those games, was we all needed to be on the same page. We all needed to have the same vision. We needed to know where we were going and how we were going to get there. And that then kind of really shaped and really helped shape the conversations for the London Olympics, which was obviously a massive game changer for us. And really set about those changes. And when we were having conversations about our vision for the London Olympics, now these conversations were happening 3 years in advance, not 6 months. You know, so 3 years before the London Olympics, we're having conversations about winning gold and kind of what our vision was. And that was, you know, I just remember being in those meetings thinking, we have to be on the same page. We're walking out. I'm not leaving this room until everybody's in agreement, or not necessarily, you know, it's not about a consensus. It's not about voting, but at least everybody's leaving that room knowing what our vision is and has bought into it and will be doing everything they can to try and make it happen.
And it's incredibly rare in sport for the same coach to have led that group through that period of time, to then lead the same group or through the same sport and team to an incredibly successful period in Danny Carey from that 2000-2004 sort of period up to being an Olympic champion. What was that like?
Yeah, so, you know, like all of us, like myself, you know, Danny also had, he changed a lot over that period of time. He openly says about the review he had after the Beijing Olympics that was not so favorable, or, you know, he found it incredibly challenging. And, you know, I think that's the measure of anybody, to be honest with you. You know, it doesn't, what's that quote by Maya Angelou? She says, when you know better, do better. And that's all any of us can do. You know, once we kind of learn and grow and we gain more experience and we have more knowledge, then, you know, you can start to do things better. And that's what all of us did. And I know that's what Danny did. He was constantly trying to learn, constantly trying to find ways to get the best out of the group. And he certainly, you know, started to really change and bring that in for the London Olympics, and worked much closer with the psychologist that we had for London, and then latterly for the Rio cycle. And, you know, realized that he wasn't able to bring everything to the group, not that, you know, not any leader can. And so therefore using more of the strengths of the people around him. And actually, I think that was probably by the end, that was the massive strength of what we had. So, you know, the kind of senior experienced players, and then Danny, we all knew each other extremely well. We all knew how to kind of get the best out of each other, and how that dynamic works just with people, you know, the relationships of people, and how to kind of work that situation. And I think that was one of the massive strengths of our squad going into London, but then, you know, in particular Rio as well. There was just, we knew how to function as a group of people. And that, I think, really played into our hands.
And Danny would be quoted saying something along the lines of culture eats strategy for breakfast. is a phrase that he would often refer to. But if we were to put ourselves in the shoes of a coach that's working with the under-14s, the under-18s at a club, even the under-12s, how do you get 16 people of mixed ability, mixed backgrounds, on the same page, having the shared belief over a common goal?
Yeah, so, you know, I did this with my club at Cambridge City the last couple of seasons, few seasons when I was coaching them. I just, you know, for GB, we had long conversations and we, you know, went off into small groups and came back together. And this happened over a period of months, but you don't have that at club. And it was literally a case of, you know, sitting them down and just getting them to have conversations in twos and threes and asking them, okay, when the season's finished, what do you want to be able to say that you've either achieved or you've created as a squad, and really getting them to think not just about results on the hockey pitch, but also how you are as people and how you are as teammates. And it's just a conversation, getting them to spend time thinking about that stuff. You know, I think for the really young ones, you know, the junior players, it's not necessarily about the words that are written down, even if there are any words written down. It's about having those conversations and just getting people to talk and think outside their own world a little bit, you know, just starting to recognize that stuff earlier on in your, you know, life. It's not even about hockey, is it? It's just understanding that there's other people on a team and how you'll all work together. So yeah, just, you know, having those conversations, and then if you do want to set targets, then go for it. It's not, there's no right or wrong, it's just what feels right for that group. And yeah, and then kind of as the coaches, it's about then reminding and reinforcing that stuff as you go along. You know, remember, you, this was your vision or this was your goal, how you're then going to go about and try and achieve it. And the younger they are, you know, they're not going to remember it themselves, but it's just about reinforcing it. And, you know, for my team at Cambridge, a lot of what it was about having fun and enjoying it. And therefore that was something that I kept on reminding them and remembering that I'm, as the coach, not the one that's necessarily responsible for making that happen. They also have a huge part in making those things come true.
And the bit I take from that is that some people would live their culture and their values, and some people would probably just write them down and have them on a nice whiteboard and maybe not talk about them enough. And GB had Be the Difference, Create History and Inspire the Future. What would be some examples of living those values and that vision day to day?
So we had our vision, which, as you said, was Be the Difference, Create History, Inspire the Future. And then we had our values. And then underneath that were the behaviours. Now, the behaviours for me are the key thing. Like, that is the thing that, as you say, makes it kind of come off that whiteboard or that piece of paper that you've written it down on. That's the thing that really makes it live and breathe. And so, you know, one example, what did we have? One of the behaviors we had was we are tight. Now, that as a statement to somebody else, they might not necessarily know what that meant, but to us, because we had the conversations and the discussions, that one was about, in particular, kind of how you visually are and how close you are as a team in the warm down, for example, or the warm up. So if I remember rightly, one of, you know, a kind of critical moment for hockey teams and when could be a time for there to be disagreements or a chance for the team to kind of go off in its separate ways and not be together, is after a game when you've lost the game. So that's a critical moment in the team's life where, okay, you've lost a game, people might be angry, they might be frustrated, they might be annoyed with opposition, umpires, and potentially your own teammates. And so, and we've had it in the past, you know, where you kind of, in the warm down, you start to see it and you split off and you start to see twos and threes, like having little conversations. And they don't look like great conversations. You know what I mean? And these conversations have the propensity to split the team. And so we were really honest with each other and kind of, recognize that this does happen and it can happen. And therefore, what can we do to stop it? We said, right, after warm downs, we're tight. We stick together. Like literally we are in a really tight huddles. We're running around the pitch during our warm down. We stay close together. We go back to the changing room. We have our ice bath showers. We do our recovery. And funnily enough, after a couple of hours, those emotions that are obviously really high after the game have started to just calm down a bit. And those little conversations that you might have had in annoyance and frustration directly after the game don't happen. And you're able to now have conversations that are more meaningful and, don't have that highly fueled emotion attached to it. And you can have kind of conversations that are going to take you forward rather than kind of hold you in your place and potentially move you backwards. So that's an example of kind of bringing how we brought the vision to life. You know, if we live by those daily behaviors, then our values would happen. And then if our values happen, then our vision would hopefully come true.
And Eddie Jones would describe it as probably the maverick, but that player that is maybe a little bit outside the box, the one that is not necessarily the rule breaker, but is a little bit more individual than the rest of the group. Do you look back and think in previous years you would have had a closed eye to that sort of behaviours, but then because you discussed them and you talked about them, you were much more aware of, well, actually, this is not a behaviour that is supporting us to be where we need to be?
Yeah, so I think this is always a really great conversation. And whenever we kind of do keynotes with companies, this one often comes up because, there are people who do stretch the boundaries and, as you say, kind of want to live in a different kind of way and think outside the box. And the thing is, you need those people. You need those people because otherwise we're all the same and we kind of don't challenge the viewpoint. And so you need diversity and you need that difference of thought. And I think probably towards the beginning of my career, like kind of the first 10 years or so, I would say that as a team, as the coaches that we had would probably stifle some of that individuality. But I think then latterly, once we started to have conversations around the culture and what we wanted to be about, it was trying to incorporate the individuality within the culture. You're always going to get people who push the boundaries. And as I say, you need that, but you want to bring those people into the conversations from the start and make sure that they are being honest with the stuff that's coming out. That's why, creating kind of a high trust environment and psychologically safe environment is really key to try and bring those differences out when you're building the culture. But if you have people, once you've kind of decided on what you want to be about and the behaviors that you want to live by, if somebody is continually kind of taking energy, and I kind of view it as energy, if someone is, for example, you've decided that you're going to wear the same kit, you've been given a set kit to wear, and somebody chooses not to wear that kit and they wear the last season's jumper, and you kind of from the outside you might think that's just a, oh, that's no big deal, it's not a massive thing, but it is. That person's choosing to be different and not live by what you've decided as a team. And if that kind of behavior is continually taking energy away and it's not living towards the vision, then that's really challenging for the squad to kind of live by. It's a tricky one. It is a really tricky one because you need that individuality, as I say. you need to push the boundaries and stretch people's thought. But to me, it kind of comes down to energy. If they're, you know, if they're working towards the vision and it's not taking away energy, then that's often a good guide point.
And lastly, just on this culture, some would call it kind of cultural architects, or Damien Hughes would probably refer to it as that. But somebody new comes into the squad, they could be 21, they could be in their late 20s, the first time they've come into the squad, they've never had any of these previous conversations around what the values are, what the behaviours are. What would someone experience in their first week going into that great environment you created to kind of pre and post Rio?
Yeah, I think, well, I mean, I think how we welcomed people into the squad was massively key. I think this, again, was something that we didn't do very well at all, like before. There's so many things that we learn. And it's just a case of, to begin with, it's just a case of obviously, you know, people greeting them and making sure that they feel welcome and they know what they're doing. And we actually decided to kind of build in what we called a welcome ceremony into what we created, in order to as I kind of say, welcome those players, and they really know what we're about as a squad. That welcome ceremony basically, you know, was kind of Danny as the coach said something, Kate as the captain said something, the new player was able to kind of, you know, say something as well. And then we had three players selected at random to talk about the values and what it meant to them. And they were literally selected at random, drawn out of a hat. So which was, you know, really lovely. It wasn't just, you know, people who you might expect to speak. It was literally anyone. And that's what we wanted. We wanted the culture to kind of really live through everybody. And actually that welcome ceremony was brilliant. It really made a huge difference in bringing people in and making sure they were on the same page. Because if you, as you say, you know, if you've got a couple of people coming in, two or three people, and they don't know what you're about, they don't know what the vision is. And it's really easy to kind of people to come in and you just get on with your kind of weekly and day-to-day lives. And you've not brought them up to speed. And so that welcome ceremony just, you know, really helped us with that to kind of integrate them and make sure they're on the same page as well.
And you mentioned there around psychological safety. Put that into real words and maybe some kind of top three examples for some coaches and people listening.
Yeah, so psychological safety. It's basically a term, just trying to think. Dr. Amy Edmondson, if you want to find out more, then look at the work that she did on psychological safety. It's about creating an environment where people can kind of show up and maybe speak up without any consequences. And I actually did my research on this for my master's, because this for me is a huge area, because, you know, if people are afraid or if people are scared to say what they're thinking or feeling, then you're not getting the most out of them as individuals, and then obviously, you know, collectively as a team. And so you want people to, you know, kind of going back to this is why I was a bit reticent with the whole Maverick thing, because going back to that analogy, if people are too afraid to say something against the grain, then you lose what they've got. And so you need to welcome that, and you need people to kind of talk, you know, go against what's being said, to really challenge it. And when you've got great psychological safety, then you can have challenge and conflict that is really positive and moves the team forwards. And just some of the stuff that I found in my dissertation was for coaches to be really proactive with their communication. So I don't know if any coaches out there have ever said, oh, my door's always open, you know, come and find me if you want to speak to me. But if you take that phrase and you really think about it, I don't know if any of the coaches do have an office, or, but, you know, metaphorically, just think about that player. Now, just think about maybe the youngest, newest player on that squad who you've just said that to. For them to physically, you know, maybe pick up the phone and actually dial your number, or, you know, the next time they see you, kind of come over to you and say, oh, can I have a word, please? That is such a hard thing to do for a lot of people, not everyone, obviously, but a lot of people, that's a hard thing to do. And so my key thing would be is to be proactive with your communication. And what I mean by that is to actually go and ask for feedback. Go and seek out those conversations. A great example that one of my participants said that their coach did was they had, you know, kind of coffee time where the coach would always go and be in this cafe at this time of the week where they could just go and, you know, have a conversation. It wouldn't have to be about anything specific. It could also just be about getting to know them as people, which is also really important in creating that environment. So, yeah, being proactive with communication rather than waiting for a player to come to you, I think it would probably be my number one thing in creating that, helping to create that psychologically safe environment. And then the key thing is, if a player does speak to you, how you react is then paramount to the success. Because if you react with even a slight negative, then they won't do it again. They just won't. And so, you know, whatever you are feeling inside, keep it neutral. You know, try not to show any kind of negative reaction and thank them for coming to speak to you. And then they will, you know, more likely going to do it again. And they'll tell their teammates as well, oh, I went and spoke to them about this and it was actually all right. So they might do it as well.
And if we fast forward, it's 2022, you're working in professional sport again, in a sports psychology role within football. Do you now look back in some of the hockey and think, I wish I'd said this, or I noticed this, or I noticed that? Now, having spent a bit of time, one, education gives you self-awareness, but also spending time in another sport.
Yeah, I mean, I think I probably already had that feeling a little bit anyway, like before I kind of stepped outside of hockey, because I played it for such a long time. You just, as you get older and more experienced, you kind of feel like these things. And there's definitely stuff from the past, which I look back now and just think, I mean, it's really easy to say from in hindsight, isn't it? I wouldn't have put up with it, or I would have said something, and I'm not sure I would have. But I look back now and I do wonder why some of the other management people didn't stand up and say anything to previous coaches that I had that were potentially doing stuff that wasn't acceptable. Probably, you know, more around maybe the discrimination that I've seen kind of in hockey, kind of the sexism that exists. It just exists in life, and certainly exists in hockey. I probably wish I'd maybe stood up a little bit more against some of that. We did as a collective at one point, as a kind of England and GB team, we stood up to England Hockey about something they were doing. And, you know, a kind of, you know, wished I'd maybe stood up a little bit more about some of that kind of stuff. But that's why it's great. I think, you know, the youngsters that are coming through are much more aware of well, everything, quite frankly. And that's why millennials have a bad name, because people don't like them talking. People don't like them, you know, standing up to stuff, basically. I think that's what it kind of comes down to. And I think it's great because, you know, what if they're not, you know, able to get the best out of themselves, or if they're not able to see that what is going on is right, then absolutely they should say something. And I think that a lot of them are, which is really good to see.
I just want to finish on one quote. The importance of people being able to be themselves and celebrate their differences was a quote from your book. And just to finish on a scenario would be selection for coaches. or selection of players for the coaches is probably a scenario of, well, one, you need to celebrate individuals, but also allow them to be themselves. What did selection look like 20 years ago? What did it look like in Rio? And then what may it even look like in years to come, having now got this awareness of this psychological safety and this wider culture?
Yeah, so our selection for Sydney was actually, we were on a tour to Barcelona, and so there was, 18 of us out there, and selection took place at the end of this tour, and we were basically sat in a room, and our coach literally just read out our surnames. So I was obviously Richardson, which is quite near the end, and I did not have a clue who else was selected, because all I was listening for was my own name. And I remembered him just finishing reading out the names, just kind of looking to my left, looking to my right, and thinking, are you in? Literally no idea. And it was just silence, and it was awful. I left the room, kind of went to the toilet, and just did a secret, like, silent celebration in the toilet with nobody looking. And it was a bit odd, because it was like, well, I'm with all these people, but I can't celebrate. And I've just been selected for my first Olympic Games. And it was a very, very strange, I have to say. And then fast forward kind of 2016, and actually this happened for a long time, but we then started to use emails to have our selection. And this was actually decided by the group. So again, you know, one of the things that Danny was good at was asking us about, you know, kind of these types of things. How can we make selection is hard. It's always going to be hard. You can't take that away, but how can you make it as easy as possible for those that are involved, whether you're selected or non-selected? And we decided that we wanted it to be by email. And actually, I think that was down to the majority of people's thinking was around, if you don't get selected, where would you rather be? And I think for most people, it was, I'd rather be where I feel safest with the people I feel like I want to be around. So you can open an email, you know, wherever, can't you? And you can be with those people. And so I think that was the decision that was made. I know people have had it, you know, kind of over the phone or face to face. You know, I think I personally would always probably stick with email, because I'd rather get the news myself by myself, and be able to kind of take that news in before then having to deal with another person, like the coach, the person who's either selected you or dropped you. And so, yeah, in the future, I don't know how different that could look. I think the key thing for us was that it was our decision as players, you know, how can we help that situation? Because as I say, selection is literally just the worst thing. And I'd say that for everything, actually, as coaches, you always, well, I don't know, but it's so tempting to think, oh, I've got to come up with the answer. I've got to decide, make that decision. But actually, the players are such a big resource. Just ask them about selection. How do they want to find out? When do they want to find out? And that goes the same for so many different things as well.
Yeah, I wrote down reflection here, because I think at the end of this podcast, there'll be a few coaches reflecting on maybe their actions and their interactions. I often say to coaches, don't just plan for action, but plan for interaction as well. We're often so worried about the technical and the tactical that we forget that it's people playing hockey, and there's a life outside of it. So incredibly grateful for your time, because I think it's going to be so reflective for people to listen and think, actually, maybe I should do this a little bit more and this a little bit less, and maybe ask some athletes some questions. So thanks so much for your time, Helen. And yeah, really grateful.
No worries. Thanks, Jack.
Thank you for listening to the Euro Hockey Institute podcast. Follow Euro Hockey Org on all social media to keep an eye out for the next episode.